In Search of Black History with Bonnie Greer. Episode 8, The 20th and the 21st Centuries, The Arc of Reclamation. We've reached the final episode of In Search of Black History with Bonnie Greer. We're now in the 20th and 21st centuries. This is living memory. This is our era, the time that made us, that is still making us. We've all been shaped by the great cataclysms of the 20th century, World War I, World War II, the birth and death of the Soviet Union, totalitarianism, the end of empire, the struggles of people around the world for justice, equality, freedom, and peace. I will be finishing this series where I started it, at the British Museum, asking what we should do with legacy and how our institutions should respond to the global clamor for silenced voices to be heard. But first, I want to introduce you to our last individual from history. This individual is an absolutely astonishing human being who was at the center of the major justice and liberation movements of the 20th century. But this individual didn't quite fit the template. And for most of us, her voice and her story have simply been lost. Her name, Pauli Murray. She was African-American, and she was simply astonishing.
I want to see America be what she says she is, and I consider it part of my responsibility to do that. It's a kind of patriotism. America, be what you proclaim yourself to be. Be what you are supposed to be.
When we think of the civil rights movement in America, in its beginning times of the 40s and the 50s, we largely think of those icons, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks. But the woman you've just heard speaking, she's one of those icons too. As well as a pioneering feminist, lawyer, poet, and minister of God, she was one of the most influential Americans of the 20th century. Pauli Murray was born in 1910. Her parents died when she was very young, and she was raised by her aunt in Durham, North Carolina. This series is about the search for truth, and Pauli Murray was a searcher all of her life for the truth of her country and her own personal truth. And this search put her at the heart of some of the biggest movements for change of the 20th century. Most of us have never even heard of her. Barbara Lau is the executive director of the Pauli Murray Center for History and Social Justice, located in Pauli's childhood hometown of Durham, North Carolina.
Her life was at the intersection of all the major social justice movements of the century. Her experience helps us think about American history, African-American history, women's history, LGBTQ history in different ways. She was an extraordinary legal theorist. She was the first African-American woman to be ordained an Episcopal priest. She was a founder of the National Organization for Women. She was a poet, a historian, a prolific author, and a lifetime advocate.
Just reading the list of her activities and achievements is mind-blowing. For example, Pauli Murray was in prison for refusing to move to the back of a racially segregated bus 15 years before Rosa Parks. Pauli was one of the early voices urging civil rights activists to shift from calling for better segregated facilities to a head-on legal challenge to the whole notion of racial segregation. That change of tactic led to the landmark civil rights decision, Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 that ruled racial segregation in the United States of America was unconstitutional. Pauley's writings on the law were regarded as a Bible for other civil rights lawyers, and her work also inspired Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is now a senior Supreme Court Justice of the United States, and who considered Pauley a mentor in the fight to have equal rights for women enshrined in law. Pauley Murray's reach was simply prodigious. We can hear Pauley Murray's voice because in 1976, she was recorded as part of the Southern Oral History Program at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. In the conversation, she reflects on the formative experiences of her life. One of those happened in 1938 in North Carolina, the Deep South, where strict racial segregation was enforced, and Pauley Murray applied to study at the University of North Carolina, a whites-only university.
They send me an application blank, and they have written in race and religion. I think I answered it, but may have said, but what difference does it make? Obviously, tongue in cheek. And in due course, I got back a letter saying that I'm sorry, but the Constitution and the laws of the state of North Carolina prohibit me from admitting one of your race to the law school.
Now, Pauley Murray is, by this time, a pretty established civil rights activist. That answer from the university simply was not going to stand. She asked the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, to take up her case. The NAACP was the United States' major civil rights organization, and it was packed with lawyers specializing in the U.S. Constitution. It fought racial discrimination through the courts. But they turned Pauley down. They told Pauley she was too maverick to be the face of a campaign. They told her that they could only afford to fight cases they knew they would win. In fact, a few years later, history repeated itself again when Pauley applied to Harvard Law School, only to be turned down because Harvard Law did not admit women. These experiences only strengthened Pauley's ambition to become a lawyer. There were other experiences, too. One of the most significant was in Virginia in 1940, when she was arrested for refusing to move to the back of a segregated bus. She and a friend were convicted of making a disturbance, but they refused to pay the fine, and so they were jailed. Something that could be a very, very dangerous experience for an African-American woman. Speaking in 1976, Pauley described how she even used that time in jail to do civil rights work.
And we refused to pay the fine. We went to jail. And while in jail, began to use Gandhian tactics on the jailer with some modest success. The jailer who had threatened to throw my you-know-what in the dungeon when I came in, as we went out, apologized in the way in which Southerners very often used to not only apologize, you are sort of the better kind. It was old Petersburg jail that had been there before the Civil War, and it was so crowded that they had colored male prisoners sort of on pallets along the corridors outside of this cell. The men had rigged up a device where they could take a mirror, little hand mirror and place it in such a way under the doors, and see, the doors were not really well down. Mm-hmm. They could keep the women under surveillance by the use of this little mirror, you know, so that you felt utterly exposed. In the first place, the john and everything was wide open. There was no mm-hmm. privacy whatsoever. And the attitude of the males was, who are those two New York whores? You know, who are they? In other words, the male colored prisoners, not knowing anything of the background of why we were there, assumed, made certain assumptions mm-hmm. about us. At which point, we took our pen in hand, and again, using the Gandhian technique, wrote them sort of a little treatise about why we were there. And by this time, it was known that the White House was interested in the case. My sister here in Washington had interrupted Mrs. Roosevelt in the middle of a garden party and told her her sister had been arrested in Virginia, and Mrs. Roosevelt had called the governor of Virginia. And by this time, somebody alerted the people in Petersburg, be careful.
Yes, you heard correctly. The White House took an interest in her case because Pauli Murray had a talent for friendship. And by the time she was in jail, she had for some years been exchanging letters with the First Lady of the United States, Eleanor Roosevelt, a great champion of the rights of the poor, of women, and of African Americans. As the wife of the President of the United States, and in her own right, Eleanor Roosevelt had enormous power. Theirs was a friendship that lasted well into the 1960s. Pauli Murray clearly understood the power of her words to influence change. So, with that in mind, when Pauli did become a lawyer, she went to work on civil rights cases. In the early 1950s, she wrote a paper entitled State Laws on Race and Color. This paper became the Bible for civil rights lawyers fighting segregation. Pauli was a deeply influential person, but Pauli never conformed to expectations. She never conformed to the known and the accepted. So, she never became what she deserved to become, a public figure in her own right in the civil rights movement. Barbara Lau again.
Pauli Murray refused to conform to the gender roles that were prescribed for women in this era. She was a person who saw herself as perhaps a man trapped in a woman's body. She was a person who had relationships with other women. At many turns, when Pauli tried to step into those public roles, she was put down. She challenged the organizers of the March on Washington in 1963 about their failure to include women as political leaders and speakers on the dais. She was denied a position in the State Department a few decades before that because her political associations were deemed too radical. We actually found a letter in her FBI file that said that they had to find a reason not to hire Pauli as the first general counsel of the Office of Economic Opportunity, in part because of her queerness, in part because she was so principled that she was not going to compromise. She wanted things to change more quickly than people were ready for. And on every occasion, she didn't fit the model of the perfect defendant, the perfect public figure. She was too digressive of the standards of the day for what women and what African Americans were supposed to be like. And so she just didn't get the public attention.
In short, Pauli Murray was erased. She didn't even fit the template for the oppressed. But that exclusion, that shelving of her genius and her talent and her willingness to serve, did not create an embittered person. That pressure released Pauli Murray, the poet, with a poet's gift for words. She used that poetic sensibility to coin a phrase perfect for explaining her situation and that of millions of us who are both women and people of color. Pauli took the term Jim Crow, which described all the laws that codified segregation and white supremacy in the U.S., and she twisted it, giving us Jane Crow. With Jane Crow, in one neat phrase, she invited people to think in a more complex way about both her own experience and the experience of so many other women of color. Professor Emeritus Rosalind Rosenberg from Barnard College at Columbia University even called her biography of Pauli, Jane Crow.
What really set her apart was her love of words, her gift as a poet. And she made, I think, her most important contributions through her poetic gifts, because she was wonderful at coining phrases like Jane Crow, which conveyed the sense of the double oppression that Black women experienced on the basis of race conjoined with gender. She coined the phrase confrontation by typewriter, which suggested that any person could make a difference. In her case, most of her influence was actually through the written word. Not as much through poetry, actually, as the poetic gift that she brought to her other writings, her articles, her briefs, her law review article, Jane Crow and the Law, which had a profound influence on later feminist lawyers, most importantly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, fondly known as Notorious RBG, one of the longest-serving members of the Supreme Court of the United States, read Pauli's work on gender equality. At the time, Ginsburg was a lawyer taking a gender equality case to be heard at the Supreme Court. She won her case. The first time the Supreme Court ruled that the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, a clause that until then had only been deemed relevant to racial discrimination, also covered gender discrimination. So let's take stock a minute. All of these people crediting the influence of Pauli Murray on major victories over racial and gender discrimination. Speaking in 1976, Pauli had her own take on the long fight.
I'd like to say here, if you will notice, the questions you've been asking me about my activities and the things that I was involved in, that in not a single one of these little campaigns was I victorious. In other words, in each case, I personally failed. But I have lived to see the thesis upon which I was operating vindicated. Mm-hmm. And what I say very often is that I've lived to see my lost causes found.
I personally fail, but I have lived to see the thesis upon which I was operating vindicated. And what I say very often is that I've lived to see my lost causes found. This, for me, is one of the most courageous things that any of us can hear. In our age of win-win, Pauli Murray is content with losing. Content with it not having to be about her, but about the cause, the good fight, the truth. That's everything. For Professor Rosalind Rosenberg, Pauli was lost to us because the world was just not ready.
People who are pioneers are very rarely recognized or remembered. But I think what's important is that Pauli Murray had to fight behind the scenes because she was in between, and people who are in between simply were not in positions to be able to lead out front. So she had to lead from behind.
Did this inform her life,
though? Every year of it. It's very important to remember that this is someone who, in her 20s and 30s, which was in the 1930s and 1940s, felt in between in her gender, more male than female, at a time when the term transgender or transsexual didn't exist. That term didn't even come into being until 1949. She was living at a time when there was a civil rights movement just beginning to build some power, but there certainly was no LGBTQ movement to support her. So she felt alone, and she was alone.
How do you fight alone? How do you take the gifts you have, the knowledge you have? How do you watch it buried or hidden? Pauli was no super being. In the 1930s, she tried several times but failed to persuade doctors to administer male hormone treatment. She was never out as a member of the LGBTQ community. Nevertheless, she used the experiences of her own life in the service of all people. Eventually, she turned away from the law to the Episcopal Church, and Pauli Murray became the first African-American woman to be ordained a minister. In 1976, she explained how she saw that role fitting with the rest of her life's work.
I think I can truthfully say that my decision to become a candidate for holy orders is much more closely related to my feeling of standing in the tradition of Martin Luther King, Jr., and my strong conviction that basically all of these problems of human rights in which I had been involved for most of my adult life, sex, race, all of the problems of human rights, that basically these were moral and spiritual problems. And I think that I was driven more into this position when I saw that the particular profession to which I had devoted the larger sector of my life, law, that we had reached a point where law could not give us the answers. It seemed to me that Martin Luther King stood for two things. He stood for liberation, which is the modern, which is the contemporary term. But he also stood for the possibility of reconciliation between people and among peoples. He was not satisfied merely to enter into struggle. He would call it, and in Christian terms, we would talk about it in terms of salvation. After he died, the notion of reconciliation was almost discarded in the black militants' hands. My feeling is that if this country is to survive, we must live together in harmony. And we must live together, in a sense, in a spirit of harmony. You may call it brotherhood or whatnot. But we cannot survive as a divided country.
So I hand over to you Pauli's stance, the question and the principle of reconciliation, a word that we don't hear very much these days. With all that I've learned from Pauli Murray and all the other lives I've met and learned about in this series, I ask, where do we go from here? How do we reshape the narrative to include the Sinya, the African European women crucial to the transatlantic slave trade, or the medieval Londoners of mixed African and European heritage, or Cheddar Man, our black-skinned, blue-eyed, early European ancestor? How? And all of these, all the other lives that are still waiting to be uncovered, must be included in the stories told about us and the stories we tell ourselves. I'm not talking here about niche. I'm talking about our shared history. But that kind of approach, that necessary shift, will be unsettling when so many of our great national and public institutions have been nurtured by the legacy of colonialism and nation building. So I must return now to where I began this series, at that institution of the world, for the world, and in the world, at an institution at the cutting edge of these conversations, the British Museum, to meet up with its director, Hartwig Fischer.
This beauty. Mm. This incredibly beautiful thing.
You have to get down,
on our knees again.
To venerate and admire.
Indeed. This beautiful, beautiful face. And the poise as well.
Yes, it's royal.
So, Hartwig and I are on our knees here, kneeling in front of this absolutely beautiful head from the 14th and 15th century from what is now Nigeria. It is very, very lifelike. It is very calm. It is very regal. We know that this is the image of a king, but we don't know his name, nor do we know who made it, who had the eye and the craft and the intelligence and the heart to create something so exquisite. It is one of the objects Hartwig has chosen to show me in the museum, one of the artifacts which tells both the story of humankind and explains the responsibility that the British Museum has to expand and share that story.
This was found in Ife, you know, the Yoruba country in the western part of Nigeria. The discovery of those bronze heads from Ife dates actually to the first third of the 20th century, and they caused a sensation because, and that, you know, tells us a lot about how people looked at Africa back then. Many people had not thought this to, you know, that this could come out of Africa.
This kind of beauty, which...
The beauty, yeah. But the sheer artistry, yeah. The capacity to create bronzes like this. You know, it's not only a masterpiece, it's one of, you know, the great achievements in the history of art of humankind.
This Ife king, known as the Uni, when I say he's beautiful, that's not sufficient. I can only describe him. His face is covered in the marks of scarification. He gazes at us, sure of his place in the world, of his power and his stature. Hartwig and I are gazing back up at him on our knees. And I wonder about the kingdom the Uni ruled, about which we know so little. This head gives us tantalizing hints.
It is linked to a kingdom. It is linked to exercising power, to ruling, because this is obviously a king and he has the regalia, he has the crown, which still bears the traces of reddish color. And you see the face has a very elegant scarification, singling out this person as somebody extraordinary. And around the mouth and along the cheeks, you have little holes. So probably the original had a kind of little curtain of beads, of pearls, that would cover his mouth. And that, again, was a sign of extraordinary rank.
We do know this. The Ife head was discovered in 1938, one of a group of remarkable bronze heads, and this discovery caused a sensation in Europe. But this head also informed and transformed and reformed Nigerians' understanding of their own particular story. So this makes the head a crucial part of their inheritance. And you would be right to ask a logical question. Where is that inheritance to be situated? Where must it be situated? Hartwig has brought me to see the statue not only because he has a very strong feeling about it, but also because he has a very interesting story to tell about the visit of the present-day Uni to the British Museum.
When the Uni of Ife came to the British Museum 2 years ago, this was an extraordinary moment for me. The Uni today has no worldly power, he has spiritual power for the Yoruba. He is still an imperial majesty.
How did he feel when he saw his ancestor in this place?
Well, He told me that the reason why he looked so closely at this museum was to understand what museums in his region of Nigeria could do to develop community, to offer educational opportunities, but also to offer as places of gathering, of social interaction. And even he was thinking of what could it do to our youth, making them connect with heritage, with the past, with history. And at one point he said to me, talking about the British Museum, he said, "This is a house of spirits." And for me, each time I think of this, there's a big emotion inside myself. And I told him, this is such an extraordinary definition of the museum. And he said, because the Uni has the capacity to communicate with the spirits of all ancestors, of all countries, and of the entire past. And he said, you know, by and large, I can tell you that they're okay in this place. They feel all right. Some are slightly aggravated, but I'll take care of that. To me, this was absolutely wonderful that he would say this, and I was grateful for this.
The Uni will take care of it. For me, as a playwright, a museum is both a theater and also a house of spirits. I think the Uni summed that up for me. It's what I was saying at the start of this series when I said that the Akan drum talked to me, told me that I, an African-American woman, was in the right place being with the British Museum. I'm also sure that the people who told me to stay out of the British Museum, they felt the spirits talking to them too. So this museum, this house, and many others ascendant in the age of empire become not just holders and displayers and researchers of objects, some there by dubious means to say the very least, but these places can become a kind of ritual space, holders of that idea, that African sense, that spirit can go everywhere, is everywhere, belongs everywhere. And this is just my feeling, that spirit can become the centerpiece of reconciliation and reclamation of our common humanity right now. But I must also acknowledge pain and rage, injustice, and sense of shame. In 2018, the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, commissioned a report on what to do with colonial-era objects in the museums of France. That report estimated that 90% of African artifacts are outside the continent. Its recommendation, among others, that many objects held by France and by implication everywhere else should be returned to their countries of origin. I asked Hartwig what he felt about that, what he thought about it, what the British Museum was going to do about it.
Hartwig, what is the responsibility of the British Museum and other institutions like it around the world to the people whose artifacts they have on display and whose stories, in a sense, they're telling?
Well, I think the responsibility is to tell these stories not only truthfully, but also in an accessible way to people from all walks of life and to people from all continents. If you look at the history of this institution and the way it has grown into what it is today, and it's a long and complex and complicated history, obviously, I think something that is really striking is that it has not only received objects from cultures from around the world and into the depth of history. It covers the whole globe, but it also covers those 2 million years of human history. It has done a lot to help us discover these cultures. Many people working for the British Museum, with the British Museum, commissioned and financed by the British Museum, and often in collaboration with people in those various regions of the world, have helped us to retrieve a past which, for a good part, was absolutely gone, covered by sand, lay in ruins and was not taken care of. So if you look at the various responsibilities that such a place has, it is certainly not only to be a repository, but to be a very dynamic repository, a place people come to engage with other cultures, to engage with the past, and to make us understand and make accessible the incredible richness of humankind. We are in the process of rethinking our display, and we will highlight in a different way and much more intensely than we do now how closely cultures are interconnected.
So, the British Museum, like all museums, is evolving. Hartwig Fisher told me that the British Museum is increasingly telling stories in partnership with people from all over the world. And where that will lead, no one knows.
I've devoted a lot of time to those global partnerships. Not only to working with colleagues in Nigeria or colleagues in Ghana or Sudan or China or India, and we've done a lot and we're doing a lot. It's not only bilateral, and it's more than a network. It's a kind of rhizome of dynamic relations of which this place becomes a part. An absolutely uncontrollable rhizome of developing knowledge. And in a way, I think if you would have to ask those objects where they want to be, that's their place. They want to be part of that dynamic rhizome of knowledge and meaning.
Where do the objects want to be? Who translates that? Who mediates that? And what do you do if you are outside that network of knowledge and meaning? In other words, you're outside of the power. Remember, at the very beginning of this series, we heard from the Nigerian archaeologist Dr. Imobosa Orijemi of the University of Ibadan. He's embarking on a groundbreaking study of early human origins in West Africa. Dr. Orijemi studied at Cambridge, his first opportunity to visit museums holding Nigerian artifacts in Britain. He was profoundly disturbed by the experience.
I was in the British Museum in London, and I saw loads and loads of artifacts from Nigeria. In the Cambridge Museum as well, there are loads and loads of materials from Nigeria. In the Oxford Museum, as well as the Pitt Rivers Museum, there are lots and lots of materials from Africa, and Nigeria specifically. I felt that a part of me was missing, because seeing these materials, I could quickly, easily connect with them. But again, to me, they are in chains. You know, they are not free. I know that people visit these museums to research, you know, talk about, do some work on them. But these materials, to me, they're in bondage. I know the argument over time has been that there's not enough security in Nigeria. These materials, once they are returned, they will be stolen again and sold into the market. I think they should leave that to us. They should leave that to us. I felt really bad that if I had to study part of Benin art, I would have to travel to the UK. First of all, I'll need a visa, and the visa could be approved or not approved. You know, so my engagement with part of my history and my heritage is dependent on the UK government. It's really painful that a lot of artifacts that could tell more about our history, our heritage, we don't have them. We can't touch them. We can't feel them. I mean, it's just like splitting the African soul.
Splitting the African soul. This has happened so many times. It's happening still. It happened hundreds of years ago, in that instant of that last look at the land from the view of the slave ship. There's an African soul on the continent, in the continent, and an African soul outside of the continent, too. It's a reality. It's a dilemma that I face within myself. When all of the history we have has been largely written by the oppressor, how do we address that? And how do we address the sins of the fathers, not only in Europe, but in Africa too? Is it right? Is it just that we still hold on to these incredible, these beautiful, these moving artifacts, these objects, this heritage? It's the question that Isis Thompson put to Hartwig Fisher.
Does Britain deserve these objects? Does Britain deserve to have them here?
I think when we talk about having, we also have to talk about sharing. Then we also have to talk about accessibility. Then we also have to talk about safeguarding and all the other aspects that go into it. So I think this is a major contribution to our understanding of the world, which has created immense benefit for billions of people over time.
So by being here in this museum, in all of the museums, the objects, the artifacts, this heritage of others has created a new heritage. This is a reality. When we talk about having, and we also have to talk about sharing. Yes, I believe that sharing is the sharing of a new heritage. As a former deputy chair of the British Museum, I am a part of that new heritage. And I also have to face and own the lament, the rage, the demand for justice of Dr. Ori Jamie and millions of others. And I do. I go again to speak to Miranda Lowe, principal curator at the Natural History Museum, a Black British woman from a working class background and a Londoner. Every part of her is a rarity in the museum world.
I think when I first started, I didn't question it at all. It was a fascinating place for me. I have a very curious mind. I like investigating lots of things. But as time has gone on and I've risen through, up through the hierarchy, I have questioned myself as a Black woman being in an institution like that. There have been a couple of times where, because of what it's been like at the institution for me, I have wanted to leave. And then I thought, no, I have every right to be here because of the collections that are there and where they were collected from. A lot of them from places where I have a cultural heritage. It should be me. I am best placed to be there, best placed to ask the questions, ask more radical probing questions. It's a national collection, a national, international collection. So it's everybody's right to know, to see, to investigate, to understand. That gives a greater understanding of how we all came to be.
Miranda is a founding member of a group called Museum Detox, who have what I call cells in almost every museum and gallery in the United Kingdom.
Museum Detox is a collective of museum professionals, so those that are Black, Asian, and ethnic minority or people of colour, that work in museums, galleries and libraries, the cultural sector within the UK, although we have a few international members. We just wanted a safe space to be able to talk about the issues we were sometimes suffering, coming across. But since then, it's become a lot more. The sector have needed us. So we're now being called upon to discuss things like decolonization. What does that mean in natural history? What does that mean in art galleries? What does that mean in libraries and archives to decolonize it? What are the things, the stories, the narratives that we want told? We want to tell our story culturally. It's always been told by other people. And if you want to have more inclusive practice, more diversity and representation in these cultural organisations, then there has to be more people like me within those, a lot more. And we try and do what we can within museums. we're asking the questions and making them face up to certain things that they haven't done for many, many years. It's not just one voice. It's a collective voice, which is more powerful, I think, across the sector and has more meaning as well.
Miranda Lowe runs tours of the Natural History Museum, highlighting the stories of people of African descent and their roles in exploration and discovery. I asked her the same question I asked Hartwig Fisher at the British Museum. What is the responsibility of the great museums? To what and to whom?
Yes, there is a responsibility. First and foremost, to be open about the collections that they hold from those African countries. The displays as well. A lot of them could be done much better in terms of the narratives. And confronting more openly the cultural objects and artifacts that communities are calling to be returned. In my world, though, working in the Natural History Museum, you know that I've been teasing out the stories of people of African descent. And so, in a sense, those kind of objects, specimens of animals and plants, the narrative's a little more hidden. But in places such as the British Museum, the cultural objects have a different kind of meaning, more spiritual meaning. Mm-hmm. It is important to them to be able to have those open discussion debates within museum spaces and to feel safe to have those conversations. Museums need to be giving a better understanding of how the political landscape works, how museums work. It's not to say that because of those rules and things that nothing should be returned, but I think just a little bit better understanding. I am unique in the sense as a Black woman working in a museum, I have feelings culturally about objects, but then I do have an insight into the policies around objects being repatriated, restituted. And it's very complex. And I think museums do owe it to wider communities, Indigenous peoples, for them to have a greater understanding about that.
Safety and respect. These qualities are of supreme importance as we go forward. Important for those inside museums and important for those outside museums, because without them, we cannot progress. We cannot rethink the future.
What does a decolonized museum look like, in your opinion?
I don't think you could ever totally decolonize a museum. The bricks and mortar.
Exactly.
So what we've got at the moment is essentially a set of decolonizing projects. So without knocking the museum down and rebuilding it, that's when it would be thoroughly decolonized and built in a certain way with new narratives or whatever. Within the current spaces that there are now, decolonizing it would mean everything from looking at deeper narratives of objects and specimens, be more inclusive to communities, to Black and Asian people, to look at those narratives, develop those narratives alongside those communities within museum spaces. For Black people to feel comfortable to step within those walls, into those great halls as well. So a lot of work, outreach work has to be done as well. And for those institutions from the top to the bottom to acknowledge what they've been built on, what they've been based on, which is slavery. So it's in a variety of ways in terms of decolonizing, but you can never totally decolonize these grand old buildings, museums, and to a certain extent, historic houses and everything else that goes with it because of just how the British Empire was, you know, at that time. But we don't want to ever go back there. That's the main thing. Exactly. We don't want to ever go back there.
Exactly.
How can we make neat the messiness of human history? Should we even try? Anybody who tells you that they have the answer to all of this is fooling themselves and you. There are still far more questions than answers, and I hope what this series has done for you is give you more good questions, Good questions are the best questions of all because they make you dream and they can lead you to truth. I dream about the Akan drum. I dream about my ancestors. Maybe they were brought down to the slave coasts, sold in exchange for what the Europeans considered trinkets, or sold for guns. Maybe my ancestors were the result of some punitive raid of one great African nation showing its might over another, just like every human empire that ever was. And that's what I call agency, the acknowledgement of good and ill in every human society, everywhere, through all time. This journey for me has been a search for the mutable, that which is ever-changing, ever-morphing into the story of Black history. Therefore, this is not a definitive journey. This is my journey, and maybe it's your journey too. I wanted you to meet the Tudor King's Black trumpeter, John Blank, and I wanted you to meet the African women warriors who resisted slavery on board the transatlantic slave ships. I wanted you to meet the contradictory people like Jacobus Eliza Capitaine, the African chaplain at the slave Fort Elmina. I wanted you to meet the Signar, the complex African-European women who were a vital part of keeping that slave trade going. I wanted you to meet the mighty Kandake queens of Kush who kept the Roman Empire at bay. I wanted you to meet them because I wanted to meet them. Surely this is what we all need, to try to know the whole truth, demand it in all of its beautiful and its ugly and its confusing complexity. I was made a few years ago an OBE, Officer of the British Empire, by the Queen. It is considered an honor, and it is. It's also an extension of the story of empire, in my case, as an African American, with a kind of added irony. The Prince of Wales pinned a medal on me at a ceremony at Buckingham Palace. No, I didn't refuse it, even though some thought I should, as a stand against empire, against the notion of it, against its very name. I had another idea. In the fullness of time, I pinned the medal on my mother in her coffin, and I buried her with it. At that moment, that medal with the pink ribbon became something else, a teaching object, part of my family's history, something else for my mother's grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and all of her descendants. I think that if we can bury the medal, if we can accept ambiguity, contradiction, and change, if we can work and work to make good questions, questions that can lead us forward to truth, to reconciliation, to justice, to peace, for the sake of our ancestors and for the sake of our children. Maybe then we will no longer need to be in search of Black history. In Search of Black History with Bonnie Greer is a Chalk and Blade production for Audible Originals. Written by Bonnie Greer and Laura Sheeter. Produced by Laura Sheeter with Isis Thompson and Eva Krisiak. And executive produced by Laura Sheeter and Ruth Barnes. Sound design, mix, and additional music production by Adam Lieber. Original theme music by a BBO Sound Machine. And for Audible, the production executive is Haley Nathan. Special thanks to Todd Whitney and Millie Jefferson, and the commissioning editor for In Search of Black History with Bonnie Greer is Kent DePinto.